Welcome to this week's edition of Home Centered Sunstone, everyone. We started this program when the quarantine first hit because we wanted to see each other's faces. And it's been really successful. So successful that we actually applied the same approach to our first digital symposium, which we held just a few weeks ago. It was actually a live symposium where everyone could interact during and between the sessions. We got to ask questions of the presenters. We got to watch attendees give tours of interesting aspects of their lives. For example, John Hamer showed us through the illustrated journals he made when he was young. And Gina Colvin actually took us rowing with her. And Taylor Petrie opened his missionary scriptures for the first time in more than a decade. It was really interesting. There were movies and comedy and games, and it was really a fantastic symposium. And the cool thing is, you can still get in on the fun. If you go to sunstone.org/registration, you can actually get access to the entire recorded symposium until the end of this year, which means you have several months to explore more than 100 fascinating sessions. Some of them include me. But today, we're going to be talking about a book that is hot off the press. It's actually been out for less than a week. It's called Bathing with God. It's by Glenn Ostlin, that handsome man to my left or right, depending on what your computer did. And it's definitely one of the most interesting and enjoyable books I've read this year. I read it more than once. But how do you describe a book like this? That's what I kept thinking. Well, it all takes place in a bathtub.
That's true. So
I don't know if anybody's hooked yet. how about this? The book is filed under visionary and mystical fiction. I don't know if I got anybody else with that. Okay, how about this? It's a dialogue. It's between the bather and his imagination, who may or may not be God, aka the universe. And it's a lot like Sophie's World, if you've read that in like high school philosophy class or something, or Daniel Quinn's Ishmael series, or, dare we say it, Plato's Republic. I don't think people are getting it quite yet. So tell you what, I'll just read the book's blurb. What if a voice started talking to you while you were all alone, soaking in a nice warm bath? What if that voice told you that everything is a fiction, and that fictions are the single most important innovation in the history of humanity? What if you debated and argued with this voice until suddenly you found yourself overflowing with love, gratitude, and a genuine curiosity about everything in existence? That is what happened to the narrator once he finally understood what it means to be constantly, inescapably bathing with God. So the author, Glenn Ostlin, was kind enough to make Home-Centered Sunstone one of his first stops on his worldwide book tour, and we're going to be diving into it today. But first, Glenn, introduce yourself to us.
Hi, I'm Glenn Ostlin. I don't know, people in Sunstone might know me from Infants on Thrones. I've been doing that podcast for 8 years. Was on Mormon Expression for a year and a half before then. So I've been part of the Mormon, ex-Mormon podcasting world for a while, but feeling kind of unplugged from it for the last couple of years, actually, if I'm being honest. So that's who I am.
All right. I guess we'll start there. But this isn't so much about you as about your book, so let's just dive into that. We'll probably get into more about you as we go into it. So as the blurb pointed out, probably the most mind-blowing thing in the book is that it argues that everything is a fiction. And that one concept serves as the foundation for the entire book. And it's going to be the thing that we're going to be bumping up against over and over as we're talking here. So Would you be willing to give us a quick crash course on what you mean by everything is a fiction?
A quick crash course is that's a really challenging question, Stephen. I've been struggling with this issue of things being a fiction really probably since 1994, 94 or 95, I was an undergraduate at BYU, and I took a folklore class from Bert Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
Rest in peace.
Yeah.
He was awesome.
He was awesome.
And he was telling a story. He was talking about personal narratives as an example of a folklore. And he was telling a story about when he was at Utah State University giving a lecture about personal narratives, and his mom was in the audience, and he used a couple of her personal narratives as example. And he talked about these stories as being fictions, and like very important fictions that color our lives, it forms our identity, and you know, all these things. And then she came up to him afterwards. She's like, why did you call those fictions? Those are things that actually happened to me. That's not a fiction. And so then he had to explain to her what he meant by fiction, how some of the details, you know, are filtered through her, you know, like she selects some things and she omits other things, basically. And she's constructing a story because she wants to make a certain point. And, you know, there's all of these elements that go into creating what becomes a fiction. And so that was a mind-blowing idea to me as an undergraduate student. And then I got interested in folklore. I went to Indiana University. I got a master's degree, and I was in a PhD program. And so this idea of fictions, whether it's a folktale or a myth or it's a personal narrative or these stories that we tell ourselves, it almost became like mother's milk to me. So when I started podcasting, and I was talking with some of the other panelists on Infants on Thrones, we were reviewing the book Sapiens, we were talking about other things, and I brought up this thing about fictions again, and it just like what the hell are you talking about? Oh, I'm sorry, can I say hell on what the heck are you talking about on everything is a fiction? And so then I just kept having these discussions back and forth, mostly with Tom Perry and, you know, some of the other guys, that came out as I was writing this book, as to like why is it important to me that everything is a fiction? I think recognizing that the things that I believe, the things that I think are true, based on even the best scientific evidence, it only tells a part of the story. It can be updated with new data at another time. If you imagine, like I was trying to do with this book, I was trying to imagine what would a omnipotent, omniscient God or a voice of God be thinking or saying, you know, from that perspective. If you're looking at any kind of human story, it's just a small fraction of everything that exists. That, like, I don't know a better word for it than fiction. And if everybody looks at their stories as fictions, my story is a fiction, your story is a fiction, it kind of levels the playing field and gets away from some of that judgment and, you know, sense of superiority and things like that, that are also things that I've been struggling with at different times in my life and just wanting to eschew, just wanting to get away from. So framing things as fictions helps level the playing field for me, and not privileging my own fiction over other people's fictions. Does that work as a crash course definition for fictions? What more would you like me to say on that, Steve?
I actually think that that's pretty good. We're going to be talking more about that as we go along, because I think a lot of people feel like the weight of fiction is pretty heavy, and that, and we need to talk more about that. But it does remind me of when I was getting, after I finished my degree in narrative studies, and after that, I like to say that everything was a story, which essentially got the same reaction that your bather had when Quad tells him to all the people that I pitched that idea to. I said, no, everything is a story.
Right.
But your framing of the concept is particularly interesting to me, because it emphasizes sort of the constructed nature of the story.
Yeah, I'm glad you used that word.
So whereas, like, someone could, I think, comfortably say to me something like, well, my story is true because it says exactly what reality is. Yeah. The same person would have a much harder time saying, well, my fiction is true.
Yeah, because I think we have, like we tend to think fact or fiction, like this really black and white thing. So if I'm calling something a fiction, then that means I'm saying that it's not true. But that's not what I mean by a fiction. I mean, it's selecting certain details, omitting others, and constructing it. So I think you use that word like a construction or a fabrication. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's parts of it that are accurate. There's probably parts of it that are inaccurate. There's going to be things that we don't know that could come in and change what we do know, you know, so all of the stuff that makes it a fiction, but that doesn't mean that I think that it's not true or that it's not real or that it's not valuable. And so I spent a lot of time with that, probably yeah. 3 or 4 different chapters, you know, like kind of hammering those points.
And just to let those who haven't read it yet know, which is probably everybody, yeah. It's really interesting to follow this train of logic because yeah. I was in the bather's point of view for yeah. a while. I was saying, but what about this? But what about this? And Quad takes care of all of it.
Yeah.
However.
Does he?
It's a he? I thought it was
yeah,
a
yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
So, the one thing that kept on coming up in my mind as we were going through this everything is a fiction thing, I yeah. just kept having flashbacks to now,
yeah.
Where the biggest thing that we're talking about in the political sphere right now is, wait a minute, that's false information, or that's
fake
completely
news.
Yeah, fake yeah. news. There are all these things where we're saying, do we not all have the same frame of reference here? How do we work together as a society if we don't all have the same frame of reference? Yeah. What happens if people are saying, everything's a fiction, huh? Here we go.
Yeah.
And so what I'm wondering is, are we stepping in a great big cow pie right here, right now, saying that everything is a fiction in this political climate? Are we just contributing to chaos? Or is there some unifying element?
I don't know. If this little book that I wrote becomes something that contributes to chaos, I think I'd dance a jig, Stephen. if like enough people read it and care enough about it that it makes that kind of an impact. But I don't really know what to say. To me, I was really influenced by Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind. I read it several years ago, and I think the subtitle is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. I think that's the subtitle mm-hmm. for The Righteous yeah. Mind. And, you know, it's today's political climate, which I've got to be honest with you, I've tried as hard as I can to unplug from. Because it.
You take lots of baths, huh?
I do take lots of baths, yeah, just to kind of relax. But there's so much tribalism, you know, there seems like people that get really upset when the fictions that they believe aren't fictions are called fictions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if somebody comes up and goes, well, you're a fiction, well, it's a fiction. Well, yeah, is that helpful? I don't know if that's helpful. It's probably not helpful. But if everybody realized we've got to come together, we've got to figure this out. Let's take the pieces of your fiction that work, the pieces of, I don't know. I mean, like to try to speculate on the political landscape. I really don't know how to answer that question, Stephen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, gee, look at me posing unanswerable questions.
Yeah, I wrote a book about unanswerable questions. So, yeah.
Well, one thing that I actually think might be useful to help everything as a fiction actually add clarity instead of confusion is, this is something I've been developing for like the past few months, is to focus, instead of trying to focus on the possibility of a fiction's truth, focus on a fiction's utility.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, what does this fiction do?
Yeah.
Like, what do people who operate according to this fiction tend to produce? What kind of society do they tend to operate?
Yeah.
What sort of information do they tend to focus on or miss? So instead of heading anywhere near like, is this fiction truer than another fiction? You say, yeah. What does this fiction do?
Yeah.
And is this what we want to do? Do we really want to produce this?
Yeah.
Do we really want to live in this particular way? Do we want to miss out on this particular kind of information? And so for me, this approach to everything is a fiction is actually a strong argument for cultivating diversity in the population.
Yeah.
Because then there's a synthesis that happens amongst the various fictions. And if we can move amongst them, we can see more. We can take in more data. We can see more meanings. And it allows us to actually interact with a wider swath of reality because we see it through so many different fictions.
Because that's what reality is. Reality is the composite of all of these individual perspectives that are so like unique and subjectively personal. Like the way I experience reality is different than the way that you experience reality and everybody else, because my life has been different. My experience has been different. The way that I feel about things is different. It's all... So I love that celebrating diversity, celebrating everybody's unique perspective and influence, and trying to bring them together based on that utility. Like, what is it that you're trying to achieve? And I think, you know, you're making me think about what I wrote in ways that I didn't think about it as I was writing it. But I do talk about recognizing that we are the authors of the fictions that we live. And mm-hmm. so try to become an intentional author of the fiction, which I think fits very well with this utilitarian view. Like, what kind of life do you want to live? In my case, I recognized, and I talk about this in the preface of the book, that I want to be a loving person. I don't want to be somebody that like looks at differences and judges them the way that I have my entire life, where I look at somebody who drinks coffee and thinks, oh, they're an evil person. They're going to go to hell. I don't know where that came from, but you know, I don't want to have that be part of my own psyche. So the utilitarianism of thinking of things as a fiction and going, I want to create a fiction where everybody's equal or something like that. You know, that's kind of the direction that I'm going. And that's probably what the thesis of the book would be, if there's a thesis.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
So we're talking about kind of a mind-blowing idea that could possibly cause all kinds of chaos. And we talked about Plato briefly. And if it does
cause chaos, it's just going to blend into all of the other chaos that's going on.
No one's going to notice.
No one will know it.
It's going to be a fart in a hurricane.
That's exactly what it would be.
But so
the bathtub.
So, the bathtub. That's a little more
bubbles
noticeable.
In a hurricane. Okay, yeah.
So in that case, what sort of person is your target audience? Who do you think would actually benefit from what you've written here?
You know, I didn't write it with the target audience in mind. So I, like when I saw that question that you posed, I thought really hard. Who would benefit from it? I don't know. There's so many different ways that somebody could benefit from it, and maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. So who would? Maybe somebody who's interested in exploring their own ignorance and comfortable with uncertainty and comfortable admitting the things that they don't know, wanting to know the things that they don't know, wanting to learn more. I don't know. What do you think? Who do you think the target audience is? You read it. I have no idea, Steve. I really don't. I hope, but and one of the reasons that I wrote the book, and I'm putting it out as a free podcast. So there's already four episodes that are out. I'm going to do one a week until the whole book's out. And I'm interested to meet people who are interested in this kind of thing. So maybe I'm interested in discovering who that target audience is, just by putting it out there and seeing how people respond to it, because I really don't know.
So this is a cry into the darkness, hoping that...
Yeah, I'm casting a net out into the sea to see if anything comes in or not, or if it's just empty when I pull it up, I guess. You know, so who would be interested in these kinds of things? And as I've shared, you know, versions of the book with family and friends, they haven't seemed to know how to respond to it. So I'm not really sure what kind of a response there's going to be putting this out there, or who the target audience is, or how people could benefit from it. But I hope the way that I've benefited from it is very self-reflective. You know, I mean, like there's a lot of me in this book. There's a lot of me working through things that have been hard in my life, times where I've been discouraged, recently times where I've been discouraged, problems with friends and, you know, just like all, like everyday kinds of things that if I take this kind of view that everything is a fiction and I can be the author of my own fiction, and why am I telling myself stories that are making me feel like a failure? You know, those kinds of messages in there, maybe that's something that could help people. But I don't know. I'll be interested to find out.
Well, let me ask you a question. What do you think that the pre-BYU folklore class you would think of this book?
Oh, I would have loved it.
Would
I would have been really, really interested in it. Because the idea of, like, I like the dialogue style of it anyway. I always liked pushing on questions, like pushing the limits of what's possible or what's believable. I think I would have really found it interesting and maybe infuriating in some ways. But I was the kind of guy, Stephen. I loved engaging people who were like anti-Mormons or especially evangelical Christians that had kind of like they knew talking points. Mm-hmm. Just because I want, and I love talking with people who had left the church because I wanted to know, why would you leave this wonderful thing? Like what made you do it? What happened? And so I think I would have been really interested in reading a book from an ex-Mormon that's saying, yeah, I didn't believe in God for a long time. And then I started thinking, well, maybe there is a possibility for God again. I'll open myself up to that possibility for God. So that shift just in and of itself, I would have found really interesting.
That's pretty interesting. How long have you identified as an ex-Mormon?
I don't know. I had a really long, slow burn. I baptized my son when he was 8 and he just turned 16.
Okay.
So 8 years, but even when I baptized my son, I was basically inactive. My bishop let me do it, which was really nice of him to do. But I hadn't been attending for maybe a year and a half and was living in all kinds of sin. I haven't resigned. I'm still a member on record, and I haven't been excommunicated or any kind of discipline or anything like that, you know. So I've been able to stay enough under the radar that I haven't like pushed people in the right ways to get kicked out. How long is that? 10 years?
9 years? Yeah, 10 yeah. years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And so it seems to me that what you're saying is that Mormons themselves certainly aren't your target audience. It seems to be aimed at a more general audience just because you don't take the Mormon experience for granted. And whenever you introduce the Mormon parts of you, it's always like, well, I need to explain this a little bit, or I need to be vague enough so that
I don't use the word Mormon in it at all.
No, you don't. Say like, I went on a mission
my church. There was the guy who said this at my church, or there was a story that I heard from, you know, in the religion I grew up in. Yeah. I never made a conscious choice to not make Mormons a target audience. I really didn't think about target audience. I mean, I started writing this on my phone while I was in a bathtub because it was interesting to me. And then I got the idea that, I've written enough of these. I could turn it into a book. I've always wanted to write a book. Mm-hmm. I'll do it. I'll write a book. And so it just kind of came up organically without a lot of planning.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Like most of my life, Stephen.
What? My whole life was planned for me.
I know, right?
By someone else.
Yeah.
So I'm curious then, as you put this together, would you consider what you came up with in Bathing with God a departure from Mormonism, or would you consider it a deeper dive into Mormonism?
I don't see it as a departure. I think there might be areas where you could say deeper dive. Maybe there's one chapter that it's a very veiled nod to Joseph Smith's King Follett discourse in the way that he talked about Elohim as the greatest intelligence that looked out around all the other intelligences and realized that he was supreme. And then like his desire then was to bring all of the other intelligence up to where he was. It was something, I'm summarizing, yeah, but it was something like that in King Follett. That idea's in there. There's a lot of things that, you know, I have a Mormon formed brain, and that I still really like the idea of eternal progression. Like I love that idea because it's just like, it's evolution. Mm-hmm. Like this is evolution, but not only in a like physical way, but in like whatever all of the spirit, whatever spirit is, if there's a spirit, if there's a soul, if there's, mm-hmm, you know, that sort of thing. I like that idea of evolution. I like the idea, you know, I heard this interview. Well, I saw a movie, a documentary several years ago. Ben Stein did a movie on intelligent design, and he interviewed Richard Dawkins as part of that movie. And he kind of pushed Richard Dawkins, you know, who do you think created everything? And Richard Dawkins was like, why are you saying who? He's like, it could have happened this way. It could have happened that somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved to this great state of intelligence and almost to a point of immortality or whatever, and they seeded life on this planet. That's possible. And I thought, that's kind of what Joseph Smith said. That's kind of the, you know, like the intelligence, that's kind of the Mormon cosmology there, that there has always been existence and there's always continued growth and progression and evolution. You know, I'm not as familiar with the forms of Mormonism that believed in multiple mortal probations, but I know that that's the thing, like that there's kind of a reincarnation flavor to some break off of Mormon theology, and maybe that's something that Joseph Smith talked about. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean deeper dive Mormonism, I don't know, it's just me, it's just the way that I think about things, and the way that I think about things is really influenced by my upbringing and the things that were very like sacred and important to me, and you know, still are in certain ways, you know, different ways, but still are.
So it's feeling more like you're saying that this book is a conglomeration of the various influences that have.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I mean, like I've got my Alan Watts shirt on right now.
Yeah.
and there's probably more Alan Watts influence in this book than there is Joseph Smith in Mormonism. There's a lot of like the theoretical physicist, Brian Greene, David Tong, you know, Jonathan Haidt, I mentioned Yuval Harari, who wrote Sapiens, talks a lot about the value of fictions there. These are all influences, and then some weird ones, like some eclectic things, like Seth Speaks. Like I don't know if you're familiar with this channeled writing book by an author named Jane Roberts, and Seth is this character kind of like Quad, except that, you know, Seth is, they're not saying this is imaginary, they're saying that this is real, but Seth talks about what life is after death and what it's like to experience reality, not from a human perspective, but from this eternal energetic perspective. And it's just fascinating. Like I'd love reading stuff like that, because it again pushes against the limits of like, what is this? Is this real? Is this not real? Is this possible? Is it impossible? Like I just like playing in that space. So those are influences that are in there, and Mormonism is a part of that, but probably not the biggest. I don't know, maybe this, because it's me, and it was probably the biggest influence on me of all those things that I mentioned.
So would it bug you at all if I said, it sounds like you got to have a Joseph Smith experience because you had your little peepstone that,
yeah,
shined,
love it,
and you automatically wrote this thing into existence, yeah, and Bathing with God is kind of your Book of Mormon?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, no, that wouldn't bother me. I started, I've got another book that I'm writing, and people who have listened to Infants on Thrones may have heard me discuss this a couple of years ago. I even published a couple of the chapters. It's called Shadow the Lamanite. That's going to be my Book of Mormon. that I do that's the Jilta Smith thing. You'll find out more about this later. But I like that idea with bathing with God. I play with that in the introduction where I say, you know, this as I'm having this discussion and I'm asking questions, you know, like I pause and I ask, like, how would anybody respond to this question? And then I get some kind of an answer. And that's coming from somewhere deep within. Like, what does that mean to say it's coming from somewhere deep within? Mm-hmm. And is that channeled writing? Is that what people do when they're channeling? You know, like, I don't know. It's my imagination. I'm playing with it. And you know, you want to call it channeled writing, you can call it channeled writing. You want to call it fiction, you can call it fiction. I don't think that those two things are mutually exclusive ideas. So if you want to call me Joseph Smith, I just, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole thing with other people's wives. I'll draw the line. There's probably a few places I'll draw the line, but I like Joseph Smith, so I don't have a problem being compared to him.
He was an interesting person. You can definitely say that. Yeah. He was a guy who lived.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, as I was reading your book, it actually felt to me, at first, it felt like a departure from Mormonism. And as I thought about it, I realized it was because most of what we hear preached about God is God's embodiment. Mm-hmm. And also like that Doctrine and Covenants verse about the same sociality we enjoy here, we'll enjoy in the world to come in eternal glory. But at the same time, there are also, you know, strains of mysticism left over from the New Testament.
Yeah.
And there are also strains of mysticism in the Doctrine and Covenants.
Yeah.
I actually found one that sounded almost exactly like what you were talking about. It cool. said, he comprehendeth all things, and all things are before him, and all things are around him.
Yeah.
And he is above all things and in all things and is through all things and is round about all things, and all things are by him and of him.
Yeah.
Even God forever and ever.
Yeah.
And so I thought,
circumscribed into one great whole, baby.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like when the my openness to the idea of God does not include that embodied God that you're talking about with Mormonism, you know. So it's like, that's not like when I think, oh, I'm open to the idea of God, it's not like the bearded guy in the sky thing. It's this idea of source energy, you know, which might be a weird idea to people who haven't really heard it or looked into it at all. But that idea of
you make a very good case for it in the book.
People Do I?
Should read it. Yeah, you make a very good case for it.
Well, I spent a lot of time thinking about it. And thinking about, you know, if Richard Dawkins, his speculation about, you know, like the evolution of some advanced race somewhere in the universe, like they wouldn't look like humans, most likely. They would look like other things. And, you know, if you look in our evolutionary history and you go back 3 million years or 4 million, however long, you're not going to recognize what we were. If you go ahead in time, the same amount of time, you won't recognize what we're going to become if we survive. You know, I mentioned Yuval Harari, his book Sapiens. He's got another book called Homo Deus, where he speculates on, you know, that Homo sapiens is about to end and we're going to fuse with technology and become a new species altogether. Well, why couldn't that at some point in the future become living energy that, you know, like we have information on the cloud through the internet, all this stuff. Why couldn't there be like some kind of biologically evolved thing? If it could ever happen anywhere in the universe, maybe it already has. And, you know, people talk about, are we living in a simulation? You know, like I love hearing these kinds of things and having these kinds of conversations. So I thought about, well, what if there is like this source energy that is the highest form of evolved life that forms everything, you know, like, what would you do if you could live forever? You'd be so bored. What would you do? You know, would you watch TV?
Talk to people in bathtubs.
Yeah. Would you watch TV? Would you go to movies? Would you play video games, virtual reality games? You know, like the kinds of things that we do with our entertainment today, if we could make it as realistic as possible, I think we would. So that was kind of my approach to this, that if there is some kind of a God out there that I can accept. Because, and this is something it would frustrate me when when I'd have a panel discussion, whether it was Infants on Thrones or even going back to Mormon Expression days, where I'd say, okay, we can mock very easily the parts of God that are absurd and go, oh, I'm going to reject that. Okay, but let's flip it. What would you accept? Like, knowing what we know scientifically, what would be the characteristics of a God that then you would be able to accept? And it was hard to find people to play that game with me. And so I played it myself in this book. That's kind of what it, what characteristics of God could I accept, knowing what we know and knowing that everything's a fiction. So I'm coming up with it anyway, it's a fiction. So.
Reading is weird. It takes up your whole body. You can't walk, you have to hold a book in your hands, and you have to look at words the whole time. That's why you have me. I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. I narrate Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry for you, so you can do dishes, or rock climb, or drive your Ferrari, or skydive. Whatever it is you like to do while listening to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. And then join the We Do Fun Stuff While Learning About Mormon Stuff Club. I'll see you there.
Well, that's pretty interesting. And I noticed that you talked a lot about play in the beginning of your book.
Yeah,
and I also noticed toward the end that you conceive of the universe and its unfolding as literally a game, which was really interesting to me and reminded me of a lot of the other sort of mystical texts that I've read, because whenever I'd always get like really into it and I'm like, yeah, we're opening our minds here, man. We're blasting past all the possibilities. What's it all mean? And they'd say, it's a game. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what? So this is something that I feel like is really worth addressing, especially now.
Yeah.
If you're willing, I want to read part of this so that our listeners can get an idea of what it is you mean by a game, because I find it compelling.
Okay.
And also something that I'd like to chew on for a minute. So
yeah.
This is Quad talking, the bather's imagination. Quad says, picture a wet floor in a locker room, or maybe water spots on a window, or drops of mercury on a cold metal plate. Whatever it is, imagine hundreds, thousands, or even billions of little droplets all coming into contact with each other, merging together as they touch, forming larger droplets, fewer of them, but bigger, merging together, coming together based on their location and vibration and mood and so many other unifying or repelling factors, until the last biggest droplets overcome their resistance and merge with each other until there's just one. And then it shatters into hundreds of thousands of billions of droplets and goes through that entire process again. Can you picture that? And then a little bit later in the book, Quad says, because once upon a time, this divine intelligent energy we're calling Shakti discovered who and what she really was. And in that very day, a funny thing happened. The intelligent energies around her all recognized who they were too. Once they surrendered the conditions that kept them from seeing it, of course, they remembered that they had always been one. They remembered. And once again, they became that grand, unified, cosmic sea of divine, intelligent, cooperative energy. And on that day, they marveled together at all they had experienced and accomplished along their path back to remembering. Remember when we felt like we were separate from each other? One of them asked. Remember how fun it was to discover ourselves and rediscover each other and come back together like we did, another one said. It was delicious, wasn't it, said another. And hard and painful, but what a payoff, they all sang in unison, like the best game of hide and seek ever. Hey, do any of you want to do it again? All of them did. So all of them did, again and again and again, in as many different ways, with as many different disguises as each of them could imagine. And that is who you are. And that is why you are here. And that is where you are going. So you have presented.
You just gave me chills, man.
Oh, yeah. You're a great writer, man.
Well, geez.
No, truly, this is prose worth reading. Read it for the wit, for the logic, for the fun. It's great reading. So this is the thing. I feel pain all around me in our culture, in our society, in our nation, in our world. And even though intellectually I really like this idea of the universe as a game that's playing itself out over and over and over again, in my soul, in my justice-oriented soul, in my mercy-oriented soul, I think there is so much pain around me. If I take this philosophy on, if I run with it, what do I do about this pain? Because this pain around me is real pain, and I feel like it would be unethical to dismiss it when there is so much. It feels like maybe I'm just going into my experience and saying, well, there's pain all around, but you know, it'll all come together soon. And so what might be real world consequences of someone making the shift that you're proposing?
Well, I think we'd first have to really carefully define what the shift is that I'm proposing, if I'm proposing a shift at all. You know, I guess what I would ask you, so the pain that you see in the world around you, if you were sitting across from somebody that was in pain right now, what would your response to them be?
I hope I would empathize and sit with them in that pain.
Yeah, so that's an expression of love and compassion, and because you want to be a compassionate, you want to be a loving person. To me, that's equivalent to those separate drops of water merging together and dropping any kind of resistance and saying, oh, you're feeling pain, let me comfort you. I'm feeling pain, would you comfort me? Can we comfort each other? So I understand the... And I think I even include this in one of the chapters, the feeling of, I don't want to like bury my head in the sand. I don't want to be Pollyanna. I don't want to be dismissive of other people's pain. But why is there pain? Because you recognize that people should be loved. People should be treated fairly. And when that's not happening, that's causing pain. So what are you going to do? Are you going to treat people fairly and be part of that solution and love everyone? Start loving yourself. Like, can you learn how to love yourself? So much of this book has been my own struggles of just trying to forgive myself for things, trying to love myself for things, because I was brought up in a tradition that said that you're only worthy if you do certain kinds of things. And even then, there's more things to do to be totally worthy. And even then, there's more things to be totally worthy. So what does that do to a sense of self-love? I mean, for me, it made me feel like if I don't do this right, I don't deserve love. I don't deserve that. So if there's any kind of shift in consciousness that I'm proposing in this book, it would be along the lines of like a Michael Singer, The Untethered Soul, or David Hawkins, Letting Go. Those are books that I read just like recently, like May, June, while I'm locked in quarantine. And I'm reading these books about how to become a more loving person. And that's where a lot of that came from. Is my response to what they were writing about. Oh, I love this. I love how they're saying, let go of those things that keep you. there's a Jason Mraz song that he says, lay down the weapons that you use against yourself. You don't need them anymore. Lay down the weapons that you use against the world. You don't need them anymore. We don't need another war. And it's a song called Make Love, Not War. And so it's these ideas that were percolating inside of me as I was writing that book. And that's where that was coming from.
I like your answer. I like it partially because you seem to be talking about a very present centered interaction with the world. So when I was talking about all the pain that I feel going on in the world around me, it feels to me like what you're saying is, well, look where you're at the moment and see where there's pain at the moment in your vicinity and go be a little droplet and go bloop.
Yeah.
With that person. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. And if that pain is in yourself, be that droplet with yourself, you know, and it's not dismiss the pain or judge yourself because you're feeling pain or, you know, like feel the pain, recognize the pain for what it is and be honest and be true to it for as long as you have to, for as long as you need to, for as long as that pain is there. And, I don't know. I get really uncomfortable when I start talking like this, as if I'm telling people what they should do. Cause I don't know. Like I really don't know. And I'm trying to figure this stuff out for myself. So it's, I'm more comfortable when I'm talking about me, applying these things. Cause I really don't want it to seem like I was talking with somebody, I forget who it was, but it was on a recent episode of Infants on Thrones, and they're saying, what would you say to people who are out there protesting? And you say, don't protest. Oh, it was Tom who was telling me that. I'm like, I'm not anti-activist. I'm not anti-protest. I'm not anti trying to fix the problems in the world or anything like that. How do you fix the problems in the world? I mean, love, man, love.
But you're talking about, to me, a very charged kind of love. I went to a Black Lives Matter protest. Well, it was a demonstration, in Cottonwood Heights at their police station. And, having the privilege that I do of being a tall, white, handsome male, I was able to sort of wander around, and there was the group in the middle, the Black Lives Matter people. And then along the perimeter were a lot of people who had guns and lots of American flags and those flags that have the blue stripe on them and things like that. And as I wandered around, I was able to be invisible enough to hear what people were saying. And the interesting thing was I heard fear from everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And that was amazing to me. And if what you're saying is true, or at least playfully true, I would need to find some way to go bloop with kind of everybody there if I were being a part of this universe that is currently coming together instead of blasting apart. Am I going in the right direction with that?
Yeah. I mean, but isn't that why you went to that demonstration in the first place, so that you could bloop with them?
Yeah, but I thought I was just going to bloop with one particular group of people.
Yeah.
And I was disconcerted to find out that I was empathizing with a lot of people there and feeling all of their fear.
Yeah.
And I also understood that they were inhabiting two different discourses.
Yeah.
And that they weren't hearing each other and they didn't know what each other were saying. I understood that, but I felt the real fear from all of them.
Yeah. I'll tell you about an experience I had today where I felt some fear. I was driving, you know, green light going through an intersection. Somebody pulls out and then they stop at the green light. So I had to like slam on the brakes and I'm like laying on my horn and this guy like, I don't know what was going on with him in the car in front of me, but he was not happy that I was laying on my car and laying on my horn. And he opened up the door. He looked at me like he was going to get out of the car. Like we're going to have some like road rage experience here. I'm like, hey, look, I'm sorry. It's a green light. Come on, let's go. And he calmed down and he went, went away. So what do you do when you're interacting with people in the world and you're creating conflict and fear and, you know, I don't know. It happens all the time, but my reaction in that moment was to think about him as a person that, like, there's probably something going on where he's confused, because why else would you stop at a green light? Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was on something or if he was otherwise impaired or confused, but to respond more from a place of sympathy than like this automatic program that runs in my mind of laying on the horn and going, "You're in my way, get out of my way." You know, so I had like that split second of like, "Oh wait, I need to have compassion here." And it, I don't know, I felt like it diffused it. Cause I could have escalated it further if I wanted it to. He was up for it. So,
and you would have shown up to the podcast with a black eye.
I would have, yeah. if I would have shown up at all. And, you know, and in today's climate, who knows with the way that people are so afraid. There's a lot of reasons to be afraid right now. But when you were reading that part, I was thinking about the utilitarianism, the utility of this fiction of thinking that we are all one, that are living these individual unique experiences right now, but underneath it, idea of Zion, right? We are all one, and we're all sealed to each other, not because we had to have a ceremony or a priesthood that did it, but because we just already all are.
Or we're trying to seal, perhaps.
Yeah, but the way that I see it is that we're all a part of this, you know, like okay.
Field
energy. You know, we're already all that. And what does that fiction do for me? It makes it so that when I look at you, I really start to think, oh, you're another version of me. You really are. Like, the differences between us are fewer than the similarities, and I can feel compassion for you. I can feel love for you. I don't remember where I heard this. It was in one of those books probably that I read, maybe a David Hawkins or a Michael Singer, but they said something like every single person that's born into this world is born innocent, and then they're misled. They're misled by well-meaning people who are just trying, you know, for the most part, there's really terrible people out there too, but for the most part, they're misled by good, well-meaning people who just don't have the right information, and they think they're doing the best and they don't, and you get these habits and you develop these patterns, and then you become one of these misled people that starts misleading your kids when they come along innocent. But so we're all these innocent, misled people at our core, and you see that in today's political culture and everything that's going on, the conflict, as I think it's such a unique time, like unprecedented time in the history of our species, that like you and I are able to sit here and have this conversation, and it goes out on the internet and people listen to it, and you know, we're bombarded by stories that and emotions that go along with those stories that we didn't biologically evolve to handle this level of stress.
Yeah,
you know, and people are feeling it. So, you know, I would hope that a book like Bathing with God would be something to go, all right, let's take a breath. Let's take a little bath. Let's take a little warm, relax, maybe reevaluate who we are, what our position is in the world, how we want to interact with people around us, and have something that helps let some of the air out of the overinflated tires that is just about to pop. And is popping all over the place.
So would it bug you if I said, so Jesus is actually a great example of this. Jesus's atonement, like at one meant. So was he the guy who was sitting in the middle and went bloop, 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 and blooped everybody together? That's why we're all at one through Christ. Is Jesus basically saying what you're saying in Bathing with God, becoming at one?
I don't know, because what you said there, it sounds like the atonement is the thing that did it. And
No. He started the blip. Mm. I don't know.
Maybe.
It was just the same kind of metaphor that you were going for. At one moment, we become at one, we remember.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of Buddha, you know, the Lao Tzu, you know, all of these world religions, they're talking about love. They're talking about togetherness. They're talking about raising your consciousness, being kindness, the golden rule. There's all these different versions of basically the same thing. So I don't think it would bother me if you said Jesus. I mean, Jesus is awesome, man.
Jesus is awesome.
I want to sing Doobie Brothers right now. Jesus is just all right with me. Yeah, I've become such a hippie. I love it.
This is great. So you say at the end of your introduction that it's likely your thoughts are going to evolve further. The book's only been out for a week.
Yeah.
But is there one place where your thoughts have actually evolved further than what we would read?
You mean since it's come out, have my thoughts evolved? Or since I finished writing it?
Yeah, since you finished writing it.
I don't know. My thoughts evolve as a result of me watching TED Talks and like reading books and things like that. I'm listening to a book right now called Why We Sleep, which is talking about like the science of sleep. And you know, like this guy asked the question, what was the default nature of life, sleep? And then creatures woke up from it because every living thing has some form of sleep. It's fascinating. So, I mean, I'll have thoughts that evolve as those kinds of things come in. And then I go, okay, now how does that compare with this other thing that I thought? And then, yeah, so I'll always be playing that game and having thoughts evolve and pushing on the limits of what I know and don't know and what could possibly be and just playing with it. So I hope they continue. I don't know that I have a really good here's how it evolved answer for you right now, but yeah.
Well, that's okay because I'm still wrestling with what you already put out there. So
yeah.
I'd be rushing to keep up.
Yeah, so am I.
Now. Well, I would sincerely encourage the people who are watching or listening to this to pick up this book.
Thank you.
It is so much fun. It's a great romp. And yeah. it also has like tear jerky parts. It's got everything.
Well, and I would encourage people as well to go find the podcast, you know, you know, if they want to buy the book on Amazon, I'd love that. That would be awesome. If they just want to listen to it for free, that's cool too. It's called Bathing with God. It's on iTunes and Spotify right now. I'll probably be putting it on other platforms as well. And I think through the end of October, I'll be releasing one episode a week. And then depending on what happens, if it grows an audience, like I love the idea of audience interaction. And so if people, you know, had questions that they wanted to pose to Quad or something like that and turn into like a Dear Abby thing, you know, that could be fun. I would enjoy doing something like that. And there would be definitely more evolution of thought there, which I do want to say, listeners to Infants on Thrones, when they email me, and a lot of them do, they have been so influential on my evolution of thought because they've introduced me to things like The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt or The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. You know, it's people who reach out and interact so that I'm not just sitting behind this computer being a hermit all the time. Although that's kind of what I am most of the time. But so hopefully that'll happen with Bathing with God as I'm casting out that net, seeing if there's people who are interested in the same kinds of things and want to engage, and that'll spark the creation of more stuff.
I hope that it does, because I thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Thank you.
This one. And I would actually encourage people to buy this book because artists should be supported.
That's true.
That's how we get more artists who have time to sit in bathtubs and talk with their imagination and come up with cool books. Thanks so much for joining me, Glenn.
Yeah,
this has been a lot of fun. And hopefully we'll have you on again in a couple of years when The Shadow of the Lamanites.
Shadow of the Lamanite, yeah.
Comes
yeah,
out. Yeah, yeah. That'll be a lot
cool.
of fun.
Awesome.
If you want to ask Glenn your question, email him at bathingwithgod@gmail.com.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to end this. Thanks so much for joining me, Glenn. We shall catch you later.
All right. Thank you, Stephen.
We'll see you.
Take care.